The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Rio Ewers, author of the new novel, No Second Chances. Stephen King read an advanced copy of No Second Chances and wrote on Twitter, "No Second Chances is a rip-roaring Hollywood noir that smashes the pedal to the metal." Rio, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's great to be here.
Sure. Well, if someone hasn't heard about your new novel, No Second Chances, yet, how would you describe the novel?
It is cinematic. It's modern day, action-packed thriller. It's set for the most part in Los Angeles against the backdrop of the sort of Hollywood elite drug trade. It ventures out into the Mojave Desert and into Nevada in the later stages of the book. It's about Kitty Ray. She's a young, beautiful, determined woman who moves to Los Angeles, like so many before her, to pursue her dreams of fame and fortune. And unfortunately, she lands on the wrong side of a drug dealer, a charismatic Viking wannabe by the name of Johann Fly. It's Kitty's neighbor, Luke Kingsley, who steps forward to help her out, although Luke has his own issues to contend with. He's a former actor whose career was dropped, shall we say, unceremoniously in the trash can when his famous wife, soul singer Lisa Hayes, she disappeared without a trace, and everybody thinks Luke killed Lisa. So he's going to do whatever it takes to find his wife and get his life and career back on track. And it's while Luke is helping Kitty that he discovers a clue about his wife's disappearance. So he and Kitty team up and they sort of set out to try and find her. But obviously it's not going to be that easy with this crazy drug dealing Viking hot on the heels. So yeah, it's a lot of action. It's some great cinematic set pieces. Strong, deep characterization, you know, with Kitty, Luke, and Johan, and yeah, all together, it's a lot of fun.
That's great. I'm curious, do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to write No Second Chances?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a weird one, really, because, you know, most of my story ideas, they start with, you know, like a little spark of an idea, you know, maybe a scene. But this was different because with No Second Chances, I actually had Luke, the actor, and Kitty, the wannabe actress, in my head for a while. They were just kind of hanging out there looking for a story to kind of fall, you know, fall into. And I didn't do too much with them to begin with. I'd check in every now and again and, you know, see if anything stirred, anything was you know, ready to get going with them. And actually, it was only when another character, Johann Fly, the sort of charismatic YouTube star come Viking, was only when he entered the scene that I saw how Luke and Kitty could come together, and I saw how the three of them might work together. And all these little story elements started to attach themselves at that point. Again, I didn't jump into writing the novel straight away. I just let it kind of ferment for a little while. And then suddenly I had a couple of, like, you know, these cool cinematic set pieces in my head and thought, well, that would be cool. If I could make that work, then yeah. And from that point on, it really caught fire and I knew that I had a book, but the characters came first, which is unusual. And it's not like I built the story around them. I just allowed them to find the story, if that makes any sense. I didn't force anything. It just, sure. It was all very organic, and it was a different way of approaching a novel. But it felt good. It felt like the characters had always been there and they found the story that they were meant to find.
That's great. Well, can you tell us about your initial writing journey that led you to writing and getting your first stories or your first novel published?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been writing stories ever since. I mean, it was the only thing I enjoyed doing at school. I really wasn't one for math, and I really wasn't one for gym and you know, geography and history and those other things. It was just English, really, and writing stories in particular. And I used to do it at home. I used to actually appropriate the exercise books from school, you know, like the lined notebooks. And because, you know, why not? And I used to go home and fill them with stories. And that was how I spent most of my evenings and weekends. That never actually, just still what I do. I still spend most of my evenings and weekends doing that. But I don't obviously appropriate notebooks from school anymore. we've progressed from that phase. So I guess when I was 15 and 16 years old, I realized that people actually made pretty decent money writing books, and it might be a good way to earn a living. As I said, I wasn't exactly, enamored with geography and history and other things. So I was never going to be like a teacher or a professor or anything like that. I kind of felt that writing was the way I had to go because it was the only thing I actually enjoyed. And it was around that time that I started writing stories and looking at the market, trying to land an agent. And it took years and years and back then we're talking, 1987, 88, something like that. They didn't have, self-publishing wasn't an option.
Right.
They didn't really have like vanity presses or micro presses. You either were good enough to be published by a big publishing house or you weren't. There really wasn't a sort of gray area there. And when I was 16, 17 years old, I was not good enough to be, not even close, But, I kept going, kept at it, kept believing in myself, worked hard, and gradually got better. And eventually, I had a couple of agents over the years. We didn't always see eye to eye. Eventually I found my way to, surrounding myself with the people I needed to surround myself with, not just, the right agent, but also writing friends. And the community was fantastic in offering advice and helping out and making introductions. And eventually I found my way into publishing with a major publisher. So it's a great feeling after all that time, I can tell you.
And you said years and years. I'm curious, what kept you going during that time?
The fact that really, it was really the fact that with each book I wrote, there were a few sort of years where, I didn't write as much, but I was always writing. There were a few years where I didn't, I wasn't at it every day and submitting and you have to remember as well that this was back when you had to send a submission letter to an agent.
No email.
No email. So you had to write, you had to type it out and send it off. And it could be months before you even got a response, So everything was very slow. And it was the hope that really kept me going. And the fact that it seemed that with each chance, each shot I took, each whack at the pinata, I was getting closer. You know what I mean? I get a little closer every time. And I kept thinking, it would be crazy to give up now because I'm getting there. This is progress. And so tenacity, the fact that I didn't really want to do anything else with my life. I was determined. I had the bit stuck between my teeth and I was going to go for it. And, it's still, that's still the case. I'm blessed where I am right now. But you always want to hit that next level, right? You want the next big thing to come along. You're never satisfied.
Sure. And
that's both wonderful in that it keeps you motivated, but it's a little bit frustrating as well, because sometimes you just want to sit back and say, hey, look what I've done. Look where I am, instead of always wanting that next big thing. But, I think it's human nature to always want a little bit more.
Sure. Well, I mentioned at the very beginning of the interview, this tweet that Stephen King sent out about your new novel, No Second Chances. I'm curious, how did you hear about that tweet? Did you see it yourself or did someone text you or email you? And then what was your reaction to that?
I I won't say I know Stephen King, but I have connections to Stephen King's family. I'm good friends with both of his sons, Joe and Owen. So there's a connection there. And he emailed me, you know, I sent him a copy of the book. I usually send copies out to, friends and writers with the arc when it comes in. And Stephen King had a copy and, you know, I wasn't really expecting anything from it, but he emailed me, kind of came out of the blue. And he said, I just read No Second Chances and loved it. Good job, basically. And that was a moment, I have to say, because, you know, not only is it a great accolade for the book and, you know, sets it up, you know, moving into the months and the weeks before publication. But for me, growing up as a huge Stephen King fan, that was both, you know, surreal and wonderful. And I don't think my feet touched the ground for about 3 weeks following that email. It was just beautifully surreal. That's amazing. Still look at that email now and think, oh my God, he's actually talking about my book.
Wow.
Yeah.
So,
good.
So what was your writing process when you were working on No Second Chances? Did you work from an outline or is it more of an organic process? How did that work for you?
Yeah. I'm more of an organic writer, seat of the pants, I think everybody calls it. I don't really work to an outline. To me, that always feels like, you know, writing in a cage. I like the idea of being able to stretch my wings and fly if I need to, you know, rather than, you know, penning myself in by this strict outline. I did have a pitch that I'd sent to my editor, William Morrow, and I stuck to that pretty closely, but it wasn't an outline. It was, I don't know, a page and a half of, you know, story, basically. This is where it starts, this is where it's going to go, and this is where I think it's going to end. And that was a guide. And as I said earlier, I had these set pieces in my head that, you know, much like the characters, I didn't force anything. I didn't force these set pieces into the book. They were just like, you know, waypoints on the journey. I was trying to hit one destination, hoping to hit one destination after the next. So I used them as waypoints, and it was... it's the way I write all of my books. It's thrilling and exciting. It's good that I don't always know what's going to happen, because I hope that means that the reader doesn't know what's always going to happen. So I would get up every morning, 6 a.m. This is how I usually work. And I'm usually done by 11 a.m. And then the afternoons I spend, you know, doing all the administrative side of being an author, which is a lot of emails and that kind of thing, and edits and reading back the stuff that I'd done earlier that day. I don't put a lot of emphasis on daily word count. I'm not one of these authors who says, I've got to get my 2,000 words in today or 3,000 words or whatever it is. I do what I manage to do, and whether it's 500 words or 1,500 or 3,000, as long as I'm happy at the end of that day's output, then I'm good with that. You know, that's what, you know, even 500 words a day, that's a novel in 6-7 months, right? So yeah, I don't put too much effort. I'm definitely more into the, even in those early stages, more the quality than the quantity. But always at the end of the book, and, you know, continuing with the process and the seat of the pants process, which is what I take, there are always plenty of, you know, notes that I've made along the way. And I often have to go back, always have to go back and tighten up the strings to make sure everything, you know, sounds and plays great. And then obviously we send it off to the editor, right? Firstly, I send it off to my, I have 3 or 4 regular beta readers that I use, and they've been invaluable. They're author friends of mine, and they're always invaluable when it comes to, offering advice, telling me which parts work and which parts don't work. And so I go through the book again with their notes, then I send it off to my editor, and that's always fun to do.
That's great. Well, are you working on a new novel now?
I just started work on a new novel. I've had a lot of, I was doing a comic book actually for DC Comics, which was so much fun. It's called A Refrigerator Full of Heads. And that was actually with working with Joe Hill, on that one. Just so much fun. And that took, we just finished it. Actually, we just wrapped it. 6-7 months to get through that. And I've been doing quite a bit of promo for No Second Chances. And recently I've been able to get started on a new novel. Very, I don't want to say too much about it just yet.
Sure.
Because obviously it's still in the very early stages where, and as I just said, I don't really know what's going to happen, but I'm confident that I like where it's going. And again, it's, you know, like No Second Chances in the novel before that, Lola on Fire, it's another, you know, full throttle action thriller with plenty of cinematic moments. And the sort of pitch to myself almost while I was thinking about it, this is sort of it. Quentin Tarantino had directed Charlie's Angels. That's the vibe that we're going with.
That sounds like it sounds like a good description. It sounds like it could be a lot of fun.
I'm already enjoying it. Yeah, it's plenty of kick-ass strong female characters. And it's going to be balls to the wall action. I can't wait to get stuck into it even more.
That's great. I'm curious, and this might sound like an odd question. I'm curious, do you have a writing bucket list, maybe a genre that you haven't written yet or a novel idea that you can't let go of over the years but haven't written yet?
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, there's actually a novel I want to write. I don't have much to say about it because I don't know whether I will. It's just it's more of a literary novel. It might be a little bit close in theme. There's a movie called, I'll have to watch the movie again, but there's a movie with Tom Hanks called Joe Versus the Volcano, I think.
Right.
I did see it when it first came out, and I'm blanking on a little bit, but I think it's about a guy who's terminally ill, who jumps into a volcano or something, or to appease the gods or whatever it is. And it's a similar theme to that. So I'd have to go back and check, but I will say that it involves a great white shark and I want to call the novel Bateman. And that's about all I'm going to say on it. I don't know if I'll ever write it.
Right.
It's sort of, maybe when I'm, 70 years old and I'm out with, other ideas, I'm all action, thrill it out. And, I want to just write something a bit. I actually wrote a novel, published it back in 2012, which was more of a sort of literary, whimsical, I call it a metaphysical fantasy. It was called Westlake Soul, and it was about a surfer who has a terrible surfing accident, goes into a permanent vegetative state. And everybody, thinks he's a vegetable. He can't talk. He can't walk. He has no response to any sort of stimulus. But on the inside, he's developed the mind of a super genius. So he can, he can talk to his dog, and he can read his parents' thoughts, and he can astral project. And it's probably the book of mine that was. I don't know. That's probably the book they'll bury me with, to be honest with you, because that's the one that everybody really loves. And so then this book that maybe I'll write one day with the great one, Ship White Chuck, is in that sort of camp. Do you know what I mean? It would be that sort of thing, a little bit silly and a little bit whimsical, but sweet and fun. And yeah, we'll see. Other thing, I'd love a bestseller. That would be great. And New York Times, that's definitely on the bucket list. Wouldn't mind the movie adaptation.
Of course.
Yeah, regular, check them off the list. That would be great.
That's great. Well, what writing advice would you offer for those who are working on their own stories or novels?
Probably not to follow my advice, because it took me years to get anywhere. Don't listen to me. No, in all seriousness, you've got to read every day, and you've got to write every day. Read books outside of your genre. Read widely. Read off. And definitely get beta readers you can trust. That's invaluable. They will offer advice that will only make your book better. Don't be too proud. Don't be afraid to, you know, take a few, you know, shots to the gut when it comes to listening to truths about the book. And honestly, the biggest piece of advice, I think the best advice, is to embrace your rejections and to learn from them. Like I said, when I started out, there wasn't the option of, you know, vanity presses and self-publishing. And I know that at the time I would have taken those options, but I'm so glad they weren't available now, because it would have meant that so much of my work that wasn't ready to be seen and wasn't ready to be read would be out there and available now. And I'm glad that it's not. I'm glad that it's safely locked away in a dark box somewhere, which is where it deserves to be. It's all too easy just to take the easy way out. But really, rejections are a good way to learn and to stoke the fire and to come back stronger.
That's great. Well, what novels have you read recently that you enjoyed?
I just read, talking about Quentin Tarantino, I just read the novelization of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that. That was fantastic. I'm a big fan of the movie, so it was really good to get some behind the scenes. I think you've got to have seen the movie and you've got to have enjoyed the movie to really get something out of this. And it's Tarantino, so you know, he goes off on these tangents, but for me, that was always fun. And I also read recently Road of Bones by Christopher Golden, which just came out, and I highly recommend that. That's, if you like atmospheric horror, it's one of the best sort of atmospheric horror novels I've read recently, in the sort of John Carpenter's The Thing and Dan Simmons' The Terror, that sort of, you know, deep, cold, chilling, atmosphere dripping, fantastic novel. Yeah. I would definitely say it's a horror novel, but it works as well as a thriller. So, I wouldn't, if, you know, anybody's out there and they don't read horror, I wouldn't let that put you off, because, I think it works as a thriller as well.
Sure. Well, where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you and your writing and your novels?
Best place would be to start at my website, www.rioewers.com. There's information there on all of my novels, my short fiction, comic books even. It's a good place to start. And Twitter is that's where I hang out. That's my sort of social, you know, meeting place. Twitter. So my Twitter handle is @Rio_Ewers. So come see me, come follow me, and we have good times there.
That's great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Rio Ewers, author of the new novel, No Second Chances. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Rio, thanks for doing this interview.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. I really appreciate the support. Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot. Now, stay tuned for a brief excerpt from the audiobook of No Second Chances by Rio Ewers, narrated by Jim Meskimen, and available wherever audiobooks are sold.
Her favorite time, her favorite place. Nighttime on Sunset. The vibe, the opportunists, the neon signs throwing dreamy color. Everything about it made her feel alive. And at 24, Kitty wanted to feel alive. It was why she had moved here. She put her skateboard beneath her and rolled, breathing warm, tainted air. A smile, as wide and sweet as a slice of orange, broke across her face. She smelled exhaust, peppered steak, vape perfumes, a blend of colognes. A street performer played What a Fool Believes and high-fived her between chord changes. Her wheels thumped off the sidewalk. Kitty Ray had been in Los Angeles 4 months. It still moved her, and her heart still made a hopeful, tinkling sound when she walked. She'd gone from waiting tables to bartending to selling jello shots at Spearmint Rhino, all within a space of 11 weeks. Then Chris Sly Boy Streeter had discovered her. Sly Boy was not the talent scout she'd been hoping for, but he lined her pockets in exchange for easy work. It was a start. It also allowed her to move out of shared lodgings in MacArthur Park to a smaller, but all hers, apartment in Silver Lake. It was several steps shy of the LA residence she'd imagined for herself, but she loved being on the third floor, where the rugged, hypnotically moving tops of the fan palms were at eye level. Even better was the way the setting sun caught her street and splashed the buildings with mauves and oranges. Passion hour, she called it, even though it lasted only minutes. 7 at the most. "Where I live," she'd posted on Instagram, beneath a photograph of her street draped in those rich colors. Her friends back in Louisville had commented, "OMFG," and "Sweet," and "Yo, still Kentucky, bitch." Her mama, whose cheekbones Kitty had inherited, as well as her propensity to dream, had added, "So beautiful, baby girl, but have you met any celebrities yet?" Well, she'd seen Caitlyn Jenner at a photo shoot at the Getty, and Ezra Faustino arguing with a valet attendant outside a restaurant in North Hollywood. "I will fuck the fuck out of your shit," Mr. Faustino had screamed. All that was lit, but what was totally lit was the fact that she lived opposite Luke Kingsley. "Mama, who?" "Luke Kingsley, the troubled star of Ventura Nights and A Bullet Affair." Kitty told her mama this, but mama didn't know those movies. So Kitty told her what Luke Kingsley was really famous for. "Mama, oh shit." He'd gone from a beautiful house in Sherman Oaks to a 2-bedroom Mission Revival in Silver Lake. Kitty could stand at her window and look down into Luke's living room, could see him watching TV in his boxers and eating Cap'n Crunch right out of the box. And, okay, it wasn't as cool as smoking weed with Seth Rogen or bumping beautifuls with Jamie Foxx, but, like working for Chris Sly Boy Streeter, it was a start. Kitty picked up the goods from the trunk of a Cadillac parked in Norma Triangle. Same caddy every time, different location. Then took a bus to East Hollywood and went to work. 20 minutes in, she made Angelo's drop, an ounce of crystal packed into the false bottom of a Starbucks cup, tossed into a trash can outside Slick's Coin-Op Laundry on Melrose. Angelo's boy arrived moments later. He dug through the trash can and removed the drop. Kitty snapped a photo from across the street, making like she was taking a selfie, although there was no reason for her or anyone to take a selfie in this neighborhood. She needed the photo, though, as proof the pickup had been made. Kitty had no dealings with the money side of things. She delivered the goods. That was all. She supposed Reuben, Sly Boy's muscle, a man-shaped iron girder, collected. And God help the cranker who didn't pay. Kitty pocketed her phone, put her board beneath her, and skated away. She'd pushed once, rolled maybe 10 feet, when Angelo stepped out from the doorway of Gray's Marketplace right in front of her, and she would have taken a spill if he hadn't grabbed her upper arm. She flipped the front of her board up, caught it in her right palm while trying to pull her left arm loose, but Angelo dug his fingers in and grinned.
"You gotta be more careful, girl."
His real name was Salvador Gallo, but he had earned the nickname Angelo because of his soft black curls and doll-like good looks. He'd appeared in commercials for Gap and Tommy Hilfiger in the early 2000s and was a semi-regular on the short-lived ABC sitcom Almost Always. Then his drug usage went from recreational to obscene, and that was the end of his career. Now his curls were laced with dirt, and he had black grooves between his teeth. There was a canker on the side of his nose that never healed